Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Rear Admiral John Paddock. Rear Admiral John Paddock, a native of New York Finger Lakes region, enlisted in the Navy Reserve in 1964 and earned his commission as ensign through the Reserve Officer Candidate Program upon graduating from Syracuse University in 1966 with a BA in mathematics. He served on active duty for 14 years with duty on board five combatant ships, a fleet oiler, minesweeper, destroyer, guided missile destroyer, and frigate. Ashore, he earned a Master of Science Operations Research from the Naval Postgraduate School in 1975, completed the Naval War College Strategy and Policy course, and served on the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel. Paddock is a veteran of Vietnam, Cold War, and post-Cold War operations and crises. He has worked with all services, U.S. and Allied or NATO, over a 37-year career with active and reserve units, as well as managing various combat system projects for Lockheed Martin. Rear Admiral Paddock retired from the Navy on April 1, 2001. His personal awards and decorations include the Defense Superior Service Medal, Legion of Merit with Gold Star, Defense Meritorious Service Medal, Joint Service Commendation Medal, Navy Achievement Medal, and Vietnam Service Medal, as well as the New York State Meritorious Service Medal as Special Advisor to Commander, New York Naval Militia. Paddock's volunteer roles include the Skinny Atlas Sunrise Rotary, the Service Academy Nominations Board through Senator Gillibrand and Congressman Katko, the New York Veterans Affairs Commission, the Onondaga County Executive Veterans Advisory Board, where he is chair, and president and co-founder of Honor Flight Syracuse. Please join me in welcoming Rear Admiral John Paddock.
Thank you for the invitation to be here this morning. Just a little bit of quick remark. I'm going to spend, I found I had a whole hour to go, but it won't be that long, but I'll cover a little bit more than I usually do in a presentation that overviews Honor Flight. And I think it's interesting because I view this as a very much an entrepreneurial project of a forming a nonprofit, and it's also a community coming together in a very unique way to honor its veterans in a very broad community that spreads across 10 counties for us. So with that, I'm going to tell you a little bit more background about the history of Honor Flight. I guess everybody can hear me okay. So let me see if I can kind of get out of everybody's way here. The deal here is to fly the America's veterans to Washington at no cost to them to view the number of memorials that are dedicated to their service and sacrifice. Of course, it started out with the across the nation back in 2005 with the World War II memorial being finally built and dedicated. And now there's about 130 of what we call hubs across the country. Most of them are centered around an airport, as ours is in Syracuse. There are other hubs in New York. There's over in Rochester, what actually they had formed theirs in 2008, and they helped quite a bit. The first thing I did when we were talking about doing this was go up and spend time with their president and their operations guy. And as I was driving back down the thruway and coming home, I'm thinking, oh my God, what are we getting into? It was quite kind of a daunting thing as I sat down and addressed and discussed all the different aspects of the program. So they served as our mentor. We began the process in about 2011. We have about across the country there still thousands of veterans, World War II, Korea, and of course more current eras. But people ask all the time about the World War II situation, and the fact of the matter is, on our last flight, we did about 30%, over 30% of our veterans that participated were of World War II. So there's many deserving veterans still in our communities, and the big deal is to outreach and make sure they're aware, and I'll come back to that later. So now, of course, we're serving, given where we were in 2012, initially serving World War II, concentrating on World War II. Now we're addressing the veterans as they move into the age demographic, as we talk about the Korean War, the Cold War era, the Mideast Wars even, Vietnam and what have you. So, building Honor Flight Syracuse, this thing came as from a conversation, a couple of conversations. One was with Congresswoman Burkle, who had observed a welcome home down in Baltimore, I think it was, coming back. She was flying back home, and she got back, and at the time I was helping her out on a couple things, and she asked, John, is there any way we can get one of these going in central New York? I thought, do you know anything about it? I said, well, I don't know much about it, but I'll look into it. Coincidentally, Randy Flath was presenting a little bit of background. He had taken his dad and a couple of his dad's friends out of Honor Flight Rochester. Randy lives over in Camillus. He himself is a non-veteran, but he had taken his father, and he's very, very, he has a lot of qualities I like in a person. Number one, he's younger than me. He's got more energy than me. He's certainly committed and enthusiastic about the program. And so he was presenting at a Rotary Club meeting in Camillus. And after that meeting, I walked up to her and we chatted. And it turns out he was just trying to generate some energy to, we hadn't formed a 501c3. We had no money. We had no volunteers. We had not much of anything in 2011. I was fortunate in being a member of the Skinny Atlas Sunrise Rotary Club. We had a lawyer who offered his services pro bono to help us in the 501c3 formation. We also need a little money for that. We went over to the American Legion Auxiliary in Skinny Atlas, and the folks in that, the women, particularly a wonderful woman, Angie Gregory, offered up the money we needed, the seed money we needed to form the 501c3. We took that and ran with it. We had first call for volunteers was an interesting thing. We did that at the American Legion Post in Skinny Atlas. And I think we had five people there, including me. But one of them was a guy named Joe Owen. Now, I don't know if many of you know Joe, but he is a Silver Star recipient. He received his Silver Star 55 years after the action that he earned it, which was the Marine Corps' finest hour fighting withdrawal from the Chosin Reservoir in World War II. He was the only surviving officer of his company. And he, for a short time, and Joe tells this story himself, he says it was the last day, his commander told him, Joe, if we get out of this, I'm going to get you a medal. And 5 minutes later, Joe says he achieved the dream of a lifetime. He became the commander of the company of Marines, and because his company CEO got killed instantly, and Joe became, and he says, and I was there for about 30 minutes, then I got hit. But he survived and had lifelong injuries, and he wrote a book, which it's on the top of the Commandant of the Marine Corps' reading list, called Colder Than Hell. It's a story of a Marine at the Chosin Reservoir, and it's a great book of leadership and endurance in incredible situations. So, but Joe was at that first meeting, and after I chatted a little about what we were trying to do, Joe stepped up, and he says, John, he says, this is going to mean an awful lot to our veteran community. I will do anything to help you out and to bring this to fruition. Joe, by the way, passed away a couple of years ago. Great guy. But he and I went up to the Lemoyne Nursing Department. And I happen to have, Jeff Bastables, who's on our board of directors. Jeff, raise your hand there. Jeff, of course, his better half is Dr. Susan Bastable, and I had been helping her a little bit with their board of advisors. So I asked to brief the group up there, and Joe and I went up, and lo and behold, we recruited some of the most incredible young, enthusiastic women and men to serve as our registered nurses on these flights. Also on our board is a young woman named Kara Keys, who is an incredible registered nurse, PhD now, I think, and she organizes our registered nurses. I realized very, very immediately that with what we were talking about, we needed competent medical support. I am not that. I'll go back into how that functions in our organization. But that was a sine qua non. Without the Lemoyne nurses, and since then, other nurses from other organizations, St. Joe's, VA, and wherever, we wouldn't be able to function. Eventually, we did get through the more bureaucratic process of incorporating as a 501c3 in late 2011. And then we immediately, of course, initiated the mission planning, which actually took place in 2012, and resourcing. And so we were basically, we did our homework. I think this was an important thing because it came back years later. We did our homework. We did it the right way. We put in place a 501c3 up front before it was even required of the national network. A few years later, they came out and required everybody to become a 501c3. We are our own local 501c3. We operate with our own board of directors. We call the shots as we see them. We have some limited overarching guidance about the primary mission from the national, but basically we do our thing and control our destiny. That fact that we organized an operational think in under 4 months is a great testament to the people that helped us out in that. And I also think it stood the test of time. We are still, we're pretty much operating from that original organization. So expanding local support, of course, was an important thing. Without the 501c3, I couldn't approach major corporations, and clearly the kind of thing that we were doing was going to require some fairly significant donations and support. SRC found out about what we were doing. Young woman, their community relations person, called me and asked to present at our Rotary meeting, 0700 and whatever it was, and came and brought forth the money we needed to seed money we needed, which is fairly significant from the very first, to underwrite the cost of the first flight. I should say something. One of the decisions we made was to make this a one-day event. It's an early start. We operate out of Hancock. It's an early start, and people arriving at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's a long day, and then they come back in the evening. And in order to do it also, we believe that we needed to have our own control, our destiny. We would charter our own airplane. What does that do for us coming out of Central New York? Well, for one thing, a big deal is you fly right into Reagan at your time. You have a contract. Fly right into Reagan, off the plane, into the buses, and then right back to Syracuse in the evening. That's one advantage. Another advantage is we're not staying overnight. We're not forced into an overnight stay. And that immediately cancels out some of the challenges that we might have with the age demographic and health demographic. So by not staying overnight, we avoid those medical logistics that otherwise we might have to deal with. Because we go right into Reagan at our time early, we have as much time on the ground as any other on our flight from coming from across the nation. We're in, we do our thing, we do several other things. But basically, American Eagle then stepped forward, by the way, for the first flight, and volunteered a plane and a crew for the day. Incredible. And all we picked up was the cost of the fuel, landing fees, and stuff like that. But that's where SRC came in. So we got through, and of course, that was kind of it was a little bit of a challenge, I'll have to say. The airport was in construction back then. And it's kind of sometimes always in construction, but there was a lot going on back then. And the idea of bringing in a crowd of people that we couldn't really number, didn't know how many people would show up for the welcome home, didn't know exactly what we're talking about doing here. There were some I would say, concerns about how it might actually work. Once we did it flawlessly, and once we got through that first one, with incredible help from the airport staff, from TSA and others, and once we got through that first thing, it kind of opened people's eyes up to what this was. We had a great resource now for the Central New York military community. So others stepped forward. One of the ones formed was they had some really good-sized fundraisers for us, CNY, Veterans Recognition Foundation, put a couple programs together for us in over some years that netted $55,000. And this is not, as I mentioned, finances are not non-trivial here. We're dealing with the budget for one of these flights runs between $90,000 and $100,000. So it's something that we have to, and you have to have the money well invested. One of the other policies, we do not sign any contract, make any commitments until we have money in the bank. And that's held us in good stead as well. Rotary district grants and many others. And of course, we've also had some great media coverage. I can talk WCNY, who did a special on us last year, I think it was. The others, we've had Matt Mulcahy and Dan Cummings go and participate, and some of the radio folks. And so we've had great relationships with the media. We usually try and put one or two media reps on each of these missions, what we call missions. Okay. So here's just a snapshot. I could go on. I could have really crushed it down to a real eye chart, but these are a lot of our sponsors. And sponsors, when I talk sponsors, you're talking really three elements. One is, number one, volunteers were very important, and having a number of volunteers. So usually it started, sponsors kind of came through the volunteer chain. So most people would come in and say they want to help out, and then they became aware of what the program was, and then their companies would step up and offer some major support for us over time. And so you can see some of the ones we have here on the flight, and that's not everybody, I can assure you. So to move on a little. Anyway, our focus has been World War II and Korean War eras, but as we go down through that, we usually have, I say on average it takes us about 200 candidates to get down to the 80 we actually take on one of these flights because of scheduling conflicts. You name it, we've got it. Weddings, family events, surgeries, it happens. And so since we're fixed in time, we keep people on the application list until they do get an opportunity to fly. So it usually takes us roughly 150 to 200 candidates to actually get down to the final complement. Then we get through the World War II and Korean War, and terminally ill go right to the head of the line. And that's an important medical condition. Situation, if we got a situation like that, and I've done it in as little as 2 hours, move people up to that role because of the all the difficulties you might anticipate. We also fill in with people that we sense are moving on in years, or we sense are having a little bit of difficulty. When I talk to folks, I invariably look for where they are in the medical situation, because if I sense that there's a challenge there, I will immediately kick it over to Kara Keys, our nurse, and she will call and kind of do her own assessment. I get that medical thing up front, and quite often we move people up. Our priority is usually, of course, the application receipt date. Our process is applicant screening. Our nurses make the first call to say, Mr. Smith, you have an opportunity to go on the honor flight. We have this because they can then immediately get the most current medical and other support needs that individual might need. And they do a great job of this. The nurses, once again, fit very much into the end game of leading up to this. They do literally hundreds of phone calls. They not only vet the applicant, to get the timely details for support, but they also talk about each of our veterans goes with a guardian. Now, sometimes this is medically and support needs isn't a big deal, but On the other hand, and it's usually a younger family member, but the nurses also vet each guardian to make sure they put the medical condition of the vet together with the situation and the ability of the guardian to do his or her job. And then we have a mandatory guardian orientation the evening before each flight. Now let me say something about the younger family member. I think I stress that for our veterans, they are not passive participants in this program. Their job is to tell their story to their younger people, that whoever's taken them guardian. So there's a lot of exchange, a lot of conversation in the day. Generally, I think it's been very positive. And as a matter of fact, now might be, I can hold that up. One of the things we do is after each mission, we put together a little photo book for the veterans it's kind of a memorial.
Volunteers.
Yeah, the volunteers put this together too. Yeah, and becomes a bit of a keepsake. We've got everybody gets one. It takes a few months to put it together, but we do it. So where are we today? We've done 14 missions. We have 992 veterans from the 10 county area, or their guardians in the 10 county area have completed it. By the way, this is kind of a loose coverage. This quite often happens where we have somebody who lives in our area that wants to take their dad, but he's in Florida all the time, so he flies up to do that. Vice versa, the dad lives here locally, and his son, who somehow has migrated to Florida, flies up, or from New Jersey or whatever, and participates in the flight. So, and the other thing we have is occasionally we have people join up in down in Washington, D.C., during the day. I mentioned it's an early start. The plane departs, land in Washington, and then you tour the memorials. 5 o'clock, roughly, the plane comes out of Reagan, come back to Syracuse. They debark, unload, and form a parade, and we have a kind of an inspirational welcome home ceremony, and this grows in size, the numbers of people, each and every mission. Literally hundreds, if not moving up to 1,500, even closer. That's incredible. Thank God we got the new airport. We can accommodate a few more people. Although the welcome home itself is really focused on the veterans. I know I make a little speech sometimes. I talk to the veterans. I don't really worry too much about the others because I really think the focus is properly always on the veteran. There's a number of things that go with the welcome home ceremony. One of the other aspects that I like is that down in Washington, what's done, generally speaking, is kind of a standard operation. Yeah, we have the four buses, we have the tour guides, we have the National Park Service police that take us around. We have getting them back to the airport and escorting them through TSA. All that stuff goes, but it goes very well. There's even a welcome home when veterans are coming off the plane in D.C. But that is pretty much, you can pretty much plan, and that's what's going to happen down there. What happens here has evolved into really an incredible outpouring of what I call our local community support. It really is an expression and appreciation of our veterans in this community. And the things that have been volunteered and the people have asked to help out with the welcome home or in any other aspect is incredible. Early on, as I said, we started with probably 5 or 6 volunteers. Back in those days, I was running around like a chicken with my head cut off. Got about 10 things to do at any given moment. And now I love to say that nowadays I got maybe one thing to do, like this briefing. And I'm sure there's probably about 10 other people in our volunteer group that can do it better than I can. One of the things I trained myself to do early on, because people call, hey, I want to help out. I'll help, I'll carry the bags, I'll do this, I'll do that, load wheelchairs, okay. That's all very well and good, but what I really sometimes need is, what do you do in your day job? Well, I'm a CPA, or I'm a whatever, insurance person or whatever. We need those expertise in part of our continuing program. So we have committees that help in each of those areas, and we are 100% volunteer. There's hardly anything that comes up that I can't probably within a few minutes pick up a phone and find an expert in our volunteer community. It's incredible. Airport departure is very well organized, streamlined. Two companies that really helped out, and this comes in with the volunteer teams that come in, SRC and AXA. They have wonderful people who have been doing this. They get them through the registration pack of the boarding pass. Volunteers guide them through the security, TSA checkpoint, plane parts, and breakfast on board. And one other thing I'd like to mention, which is Mil Bio handout. About the second or third flight, I started asking myself, who are these veterans? I had these little conversations at the airport, but I was getting onesie twosies. I really didn't know them, as I'd like to know who was on the plane. I felt everybody else deserved that as well. So I formed a team of veterans themselves. I know several people in the room that have done that for me. I have Army veterans calling Army veterans, Navy guys calling Navy guys, and we talk the language. We can burn through. I know in my family, I start to tell one of my Navy SEA stories, their eyes glaze over. And so consequently, this has happened to me quite often, numbers of times where I'll call somebody and say, I don't want to talk about that, you know. And then you get in a conversation, 45 minutes later, an hour later, you finally can break off the phone and stop telling each other the stories. And then we take that, and as I say, the Mil Bio researchers, I call them, like Arnie does Air Force, comes and helps out. And then we put it together in a handout that is a conversation starter. It's not authoritative. You want to tell a lie, fine, a little fib, whatever. But kind of where'd you come from? Where's your home? What did you do in the service? What did you do after the service? And usually many times long, successful, rewarding lives of service and profession that's just incredible. But that looks something like this. We give it to everybody. And we keep them. So now we have a repository of about, obviously hundreds of these stories that serve as a great starting point for a conversation or for more research. And we have become a bit of a go-to for the local news folks call and say, hey, do you know anybody that was on D-Day? Is it any possible that you know somebody that was at D-Day? And we do a little search, and lo and behold, we have 9 folks that come up out of our little thing that says they were at D-Day and are with us. And so it's an incredible resource in that respect. So moving right along, I'm going to take up all the time. All right. Enthusiastic greeting at the down there, military representatives, board buses, and the Park Service Police Escort, which I think many of the veterans on this thing think is the fanciest, best deal of going through the traffic with the motorcycles and the waving of the wands and pushing everybody aside and moving right up to where we need to be to visit the memorials. They tour the World War II Memorial, of course, and we're here as obviously the oldest veterans are with us are usually the World War II era folks. We take a pictures at the various memorials for appropriate. We do a group shot. Is that usually at the World War II Memorial, right?
Each memorial
now, yeah, with Korean War, and then we do the group shots. Korean War, Vietnam War, Lincoln Memorial, Arlington Cemetery, changing of the guard. When we're making our commitments early on, one of the key things is two key things. One is when American Airlines or whoever we're buying the charter jet from opens up the bidding to get we're in competition with other sporting groups and what have you. And so when the bidding opens, we have people sitting on the website, and for the May flight, we arranged the May flight 8 minutes after the bidding opened. And so we had that commitment. So you wanna have that early on, and that's about 5 or 6 months in advance. And then the other thing is everything revolves around our time at the Arlington Cemetery for the changing of guard. We need that time and commitment in the early to mid-afternoon. So we do that. And then we come back to a welcome home. What you see up on top is the fire hose salute arch, water arch for the returning aircraft. And then you get hundreds of these kinds of situations, lots and lots of placards and notes, and it's very moving, actually. Way forward, mission 15, May 2nd. Mission 16, we haven't set it. We'll probably set the date next week. We have a board meeting next week. Always contingent on timely funding for the reasons I mentioned earlier. The aircraft, the buses, the DC slot, and also the time at Arlington. There's another program, because obviously many of our local families have veterans in their world that have passed away or may even pass. They may be on the waiting list. And we have a Flags of Our Heroes program. Basically, the family provides us with the nominates the person and provides a photo. And we take that on the mission to Washington, and we comes back. It's photographed down there. Kind of a display, a little bit like right. Well, you can see it, something like that, at the appropriate memorial, and then they come back, and these Gene Gissen, who is the professional photographer, and some others that work with him to do this, really put a nice thing together. I would say that this started out of the Honor Flight National notebooks that suggested something like this, but what Tom Shaw, our Honor Flight Syracuse director, and Gene Gissen have put together that far exceeds anything I know of from any other hub in the nation. They do a great job, and then they put together a program that we do now at an appropriate location. We've done it at American Legion Post. We've also, but now we're for Mission 14, we're going to use the Onondaga County War Memorial Hall, and it becomes. I think we got about 70 veterans on this. That are being represented that way. And the families come, they receive it. There's a program that goes with it. The photos are displayed and some nice words. It's a very formal, moving event. So our continuing needs probably run like the outreach. If you know anybody in your neighborhood, and I want to stress a couple points. Number one, if you served honorably, you deserve to go. You served on that dotted line. Some of these veterans have the arrogance to think that they actually, once they sign on that dotted line, they controlled their future. Maybe it worked out for them, but most don't. And I know my own experience over 37 years, and once you sign on that line, you go. You may or may not have gone to Vietnam. You may or may not have gone to Mideast, but maybe you did something back here in the States. But if they decided 1, 2, 3, you're gonna go over there, you go. And that's the way we view this. We don't get hung up on what you actually did. You signed on the dotted line, you deserve to go. Second point, the concern about medical condition and ability to weather through the day. Well, we've done this now for nearly 1,000 veterans. We've just about handled everything. The nurses do a phenomenal job of preparing, understanding the needs, the medical and the physical support needs of the, and working with the airline and everybody involved to make sure we've had oxygen, we've arranged oxygen on the other end. We've done they're the people. That's why we have them make the first phone call. Development and the volunteer talent, of course, we're always open to volunteers. The dynamics of the whole program, people come and go and different situations or even new ideas come up. One of the other things we look ahead at the way forward for Honor Flight, what kind of additional things, what might we do with our veteran community? So with that, I think that may get me to where I really want to be. Yes, here's our website, honorflightsyracuse.org. The website has all the forms. You can download them, or you can print them out and simply mail them to us, or you can just call. I get these all the time, probably several a week, where people call, I don't know how to do web, I don't do this, I don't do that. I immediately put a self-contained package in the mail, with all the stuff they need, a little flyer on how to do it. This is kind of interesting. This has been the Honor Flight phone system that's set up by our IT guy has been pretty good too. Because when you call, we're a virtual organization. We don't have an executive director. We don't have any paid staff, 100% volunteer. But when you call that number, you leave a voicemail. And that voicemail is turned into a WAV file, which is a sound file. That pops up if it's item number one, which is mine. It comes to me, or it can go to the nurse or whatever. But if the general, all the general ones come right to me, they pop right up on my email is an email with a WAV file attached, and I punch that, and within seconds, I'm hearing that voicemail. So it's worked out really well. It's an incredible asset because often I'm calling people back, and they never expected a call back so quickly. We operate like a 24/7 operation in that sense. So this is kind of a picture of the last welcome home with all our veterans and the guardians in the yellow and the veterans in the red and so forth, and the ceremony at the main concourse of the Hancock Airport. And with that, a little video, and then we'll Q&A it.
I was in the Navy, 43 to 46. It was a life experience, eye-awakening experience. You grew up in a hurry. You had to. I was only 18 when I went in. Out of nine people, only two of us escaped, and the navigator and myself. Out of nine people, the rest perished. First year I was there, I picked up two bodies. One was from the Bataan Death March, a captain from the Second World War, and the other one was from Korea, from Hamburger Hill. And they had a little loop, come up over the mountain, hit a tree, and got killed them both on Easter Sunday.
I was heartbroken because I didn't, there was a war going on. But, I thought I had a good chance to go to Europe, but they... The recruiter said they don't need troops in Europe. They need troops in Korea, and he was right.
Got my draft notice as a Christmas present in 1968. Get some specialty, I won't have to go to Vietnam. Turned out we all went to Vietnam. Well,
about a year after the war ended, my fingers all turned white. Doctors didn't know. Finally, they found a doctor, says that's radioactivity. But if I'd held it much longer, I probably would have lost my fingers, so.
Today is one of the best days I've had, and I don't know how long. It's really wonderful, and these people here, they treated us like generals.
The amount of people that are out here and the response that they give or given to the veterans, it's amazing. Yeah.
I don't think I could explain it to everybody what a reception it is, or people that are strangers come over to say thank you. It's just unreal.
Okay, that last gentleman is Mike Gaspo, one of our board members. Mike is our vice president in operations. He has been our mission team leader for the first 13 missions. His successor is Eric Amberge on the most recent one, but Mike will, of course, as we look to do more, Mike will be heavily involved in anything we do, of course. So with that, any questions or comments? I'm probably about 100 facts I probably should have thrown out. One I think I started to talk about was some reluctance of veterans to go. Please encourage them to let us make that decision. We can talk to you, we can have a nurse discuss your support needs or whatever. That's one thing. I mentioned that if you sign on the line, you deserve to go. And then it just becomes a matter of the date. We've usually been able to handle almost anything. I can't think of anything we haven't, quite frankly. Yes, sir.
I didn't understand the way the bidding system for the plane, you have to wait. I don't understand why you can't just go charter a jet.
Well, these are scarce resources. You understand economics? And so they've had the airline companies have actually set up a reservation system. And they say, yeah, we're going to have so many planes. They kind of, it's like a scheduling. I'm quite familiar with this in a military sense. We had quarterly scheduling conferences where we would decide what ship's going to go where and going to do what. Well, they have these standing things to support the SU basketball team, football, whatever, over the course. There's all kinds of requests for these planes, and they are a scarce resource. And so when the opportunity when they say, okay, we're going to allow bidding beginning on the 1st of April, you have to sit on that website and be there firstest and willing to sign the commitment and make the commitment that you've got that plane and sign a contract very quickly. Otherwise, you come up short. The other thing is you're looking for, not only are you looking for the plane, which you can probably get a plane, but you're also looking for the plane that's going to meet your exact needs, namely flying into Reagan, flying out of Reagan, and have the capacity we need. So that's the reason. But it's basically a very much a resource-driven issue, a scarcity of that charter plane resource.
Just to add to John's point, the 737-800 issue problem has created a greater scarcity of airplanes.
Good point.
And the demand out there for air travel is huge. So that's why we have to get fast into a queue and get our charters, because there aren't enough airplanes.
Yes, ma'am.
Who are the people who come out to welcome them home? Are they people, is that spontaneous? Or
the community is welcome to come. Usually it's heavily made up by friends and families of the veterans. Which brings up another point, because the demographic of the crowd that we have is also a concern because of the age you might expect of people that come back, wives, husbands, whatever, that come out to these things. And so we actually have a small nurse team that goes through and is assessing, because there's delays. It takes a little while to get through the arch, the water arch. It takes a little way. And so we have We realized that early on, that we really need to take care of the folks that are waiting for the event. So, any, does that answer your question? Okay, now somebody else?
Yeah, this is really not a question, but a comment. Thank you all very much. I have had association with the organization. You do a wonderful, wonderful job. We are really proud to be in Syracuse and to have you here doing that.
Well, thank you. That's a great compliment to our team. Like I say, I do briefs now. I got 400 volunteers that do everything better than I can. But that's great. We have an incredible, the community support has been truly wonderful. I could never have predicted what it would have been. I say that again and again about almost every aspect of this problem. I could never have foreseen what it meant and what it would become.
Do you have to coordinate with the Park Service in the Washington end so that, because there's obviously all these flights coming from other communities,
right,
so you don't wind up with 50 buses at the same time or something?
Firstest with the mostest. We are, that's why it's so important that we're ready to step right up to the plate on the plane, on the time at Arlington, on the National Park Service police, on the buses. All these things are basically scarce resources, and you need to be there. The timing is everything to get exactly what you want to put together the program.
Is the itinerary for each trip the same, and if so, could you walk through it, the sequence of sites that you go to? Does it begin with the World War II site? The Korean site, the Vietnam, the Lincoln Cemetery. I just wonder what the day.
Yeah, I would just say that, first off, I'm going to say that each of the missions is tailored to the circumstances. Generally speaking, around the arrival time at Reagan and when we have the Arlington time for the changing of the guard. And with that, I'm going to enlist the support of Jeff, who was just on the last flight, and he can talk the details.
Yes, so we arrive in Washington, and to date we've gone first to the World War II Memorial. That's where we stop. We spend an hour to an hour and a half there, and it's a time of a lot of reflection for many of the veterans. It's a downtime, and so they talk and tell us some of their stories, tell their guardian their stories. Then we move on typically to the Vietnam and Korean memorials, because they're very close by, and we spend a good chunk of time there. Usually have lunch at that area, at those two areas. Usually parked somewhere around the Lincoln Memorial, and they walk into the two memorials, Korean and Vietnam. After that, we leave. We've had some variation after that. We try to get to the Marine Memorial, the Iwo Jima Memorial. It was under renovation for several years, but it's brand spanking new. The patina on that is spectacular. We stop there. Sometimes we get off. Sometimes we don't, depending on time. We then go to the Air Force Memorial, which is this marvelous new memorial with giant contrails reaching to the sky. Often get off the bus there. And then we head to Reagan Airport, where the veterans are very often entertained by various groups of people. Some are entertainment people, dancers, period dancers, singers. The United States Military Academy Alumni Veteran Glee Club entertains us very often. It's quite a spectacle. And people going on flights just stop and walk over and participate. The entire day is very moving. John?
Yeah, and we also have groups down there, Georgetown veterans, some others that SU alumni that join up with us and help out. Some of the folks, the commandant of the Military District Washington was Chip Rock, who was from Baldwinsville. He was an admiral in charge of, and we have, I always try and make a few calls to friends and let them know that Syracuse is coming, and we usually have some really interesting, wonderful people out there. I know our groups have met up with Bob Dole, they've met up with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff a couple times, they've met up with the other very interesting people, shall we say, from that happen to be down there in the Washington area. Try and keep our local folks in tune to what we're doing up here so they happen to be in Washington, they come over and chime in.
Syracuse or the area?
No. That's another point I wanted to make. I kind of alluded to this, but it doesn't matter. And as a matter of fact, if you can come from California to go on one of our flights. It's all about convenience. We really only use the 10-county area for outreach efforts and perhaps for fundraising. That gives us a kind of a rough area. But anybody from anywhere can come and be on one of our flights. It's really about the family and the veteran, and of course, with the Flags of Our Heroes, it's just simply filling out a form, which you can do online, or you can simply download, print out, and send in, and then we'll be in touch with you to get a photo. Usually it's a cherished photo, by the way. We don't lose those.
If there's something you could do for veterans as it relates to honor flights, two things. One, think hard, if it requires that, about a family member or a friend or a neighbor who was a veteran who was deceased, any period. They're eligible for Flags of Our Heroes.
Yeah.
And it would be wonderful if you submitted their names. And the same for veterans. As John said, it's open to any veteran. And the help you can be is help us identify these people. They're dying quickly, certainly World War II period. And so the help you can be is find a veteran, help them fill out the application, and send it in. It's pretty simple.
I was wish I could have had my aunt and my uncle and my family go on honor flight, and my father-in-law, for that matter. Father-in-law was in the Army Air Forces. My uncle was in the Army Air Forces. He was a Bolt turret gunner in a B-17. He basically the only survivor of his flight, and he was burned horribly. And he died young, age 56, but basically it was sad situation in our family for many years. And then the other is my aunt, who was she graduated from SU in about 1937, summa cum laude, started her teaching career. They formed the Women Marine Reserve in late 42, early 43, and she went down and enlisted in the Women Marine Reserve.
How much does it cost to rent a jet for a day, charter jet, roughly?
Oh, probably $80K is a good start. $85K, of course. I allow for inflation. Just the airplane.
Interesting point is the last mission. One of the things that's happened is the cost of airline charters has gone up. John was giving a lesson in economics, supply and demand. The airline added a cost for food. It was significant. It used to be part of our charter cost, and Dick Blanchett, who's many of you may know, who's one of our top volunteers, is on our board, had a relationship with the Dunkin' Donuts people who have provided donuts for every mission, and Dick called and said, you know, we'd like to buy some meals at the airport to deliver to the veterans at the airport for breakfast so we don't have to pay basically $7,500 additional cost. And the Dunkin' Donuts leadership said, no, we're going to provide you with breakfast. And so they get a much better breakfast than we ever got before. And it was all donated. This is one of the stories of Honor Flight. The generosity of this community is incredible.
Please join me in thanking Rear Admiral to come speak with us.
Thank you.